This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Lori Vallow-Daybell, the so-called doomsday mom, is sentenced to life in prison without parole in Idaho for killing her two children with claims they were zombies. CBS's Jonathan Vigliotti.
Lori Daybell stared straight ahead as an Idaho judge imposed the maximum sentence allowed.
That a mother killed her own children, and you simply have no remorse for it.
Daybell had been convicted of murdering two of her children, 16-year-old Tylee and 7-year-old JJ, and conspiring to kill Tammy Daybell before marrying Tammy's husband, Chad. In court, Daybell spoke out for the first time.
Jesus Christ knows that no one was murdered in this case. Accidental deaths happen.
A man with a gun tried to get into the Margolin Hebrew Academy in Memphis, Tennessee, but couldn't, so he fired shots outside of the building and drove off. Assistant Police Chief Don Crow.
Thankfully, that school had a great safety procedure and process in place and avoided anyone being harmed or injured at that scene.
During a traffic stop, Crow says an officer shot the suspect when the man got out of his vehicle with a gun in hand. The suspect was taken to a hospital in critical condition. Phoenix ends its 31-day streak of highs at or above 110 degrees. Reaching at 108 today as rain eased the heat wave. But National Weather Service meteorologist Tom Frieder says it won't last
by
long.
By this weekend, we're talking about extreme temperatures for highs again from Arizona all the way to Texas, where more records could be broken.
CBS's Matt Piper reports on how a major racetrack plans to protect horses after many deaths before and after the Kentucky Derby.
Churchill Downs will implement safety measures for its September meet, including new track surface maintenance equipment. It follows the deaths of 12 horses before and after the Kentucky Derby in May. There are still questions surrounding the deaths, but Dr. Joanna Grossman with the Animal Welfare Institute in Washington says they have heard calls from people to end horse racing altogether.
We do increasingly hear a lot of people expressing anger and frustration and questioning whether racing has a future in the United States.
But she says the new implementations from the track are steps in the right direction. Matt Piper, CBS News.
Lenny Lopez has noticed the jump at the pump while filling up his Jeep Gladiator in Atlanta.
They're almost at $4 a gallon. We're at $3.99. Not too long ago, they were about $2.50, I believe, and it's almost about $70, $80 to fill up.
Reasons for the spike: Saudi Arabia is pumping less oil, the U.S. release of crude from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve have ended, and increased summer driving and the recent extreme heat also takes a hole on the toll, that is, on the refineries. This is CBS News.
Hire with minimal effort and max speed with Indeed. Their hiring solution platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates efficiently. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
The biannual
Civic Media Radio Stations, providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
For 105.7 WCFW and the Tap FM 93.5, I'm Jimmy Kuska. Here's what you need to know in the Chippewa Valley. No one is hurt after a house fire in Chippewa Falls on Saturday. The Chippewa Falls Fire Department said that a cat and a dog were rescued from the fire, but no people were hurt. The fire caused about $75,000 in damage and likely started in the kitchen, with fire damage kept to the first floor of the home on the 800 block of Dover Street. The fire department said that the fire is under investigation. One person is dead after a crash in Rusk County on Friday. The sheriff's office said the crash happened on Highway 40 near Hutchinson Road in the town of Big Bend, or about 6 miles southwest of Bruce. The crash involved a pickup truck and a semi-truck, with the pickup truck driver found dead at the scene. The semi-truck driver was treated for injuries and released. The crash is being investigated. The National Weather Service in the Twin Cities says today will be pleasant, with temperatures getting to around 80 degrees. We'll warm up by midweek when storm chances return. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Kuska.
She's the newest of seven elected Wisconsin Supreme Court justices. Janet Protasiewicz begins her 10-year term in August when she is sworn in. It's a long-time tradition which includes use of the court's seal created in 1848. But did you know it features the scales of justice, but not carried by a blindfolded Greek goddess? Instead, a hand holds the scales, representing justice is in human hands. It also means everything is official once the seal is stamped on any court documents. For Civic Media,
Media. I'm Terry Barr. Flowers, vegetables, and crab apples, some of the first Marathon County Fair attractions, and showed us proof those crops could grow there. Started in 1868 by the Agricultural Society, the Wisconsin Valley Fair in Wausau began as a place to buy and sell those types of goods. Today, it's considered one of the best in the state, featuring displays, demos, and big-name entertainment included with the price of your ticket. The Wisconsin Valley Fair runs August 1st to the 6th in Wausau. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
If I could be you,
and you could be me,
for just 1 hour,
if you could find a way
to get inside
each other's mind,
walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out, and for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed. Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
Port. Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So President Biden tweeted out, I think it was yesterday, we're asking the Department of Labor to issue a heat hazard alert that reaffirms workers have heat-related protections under federal law. We should be protecting workers from hazardous conditions, and I will call out states that refuse to protect those who work in this awful heat. That would be you, Texas. Everyone's still looking at you because your Death Star bill, which is incredible to me that you would even do that. But good on the president for doing this. I mean, you know, for me as a union guy, this is one of those things that the union should be out there fighting for. And we see this in the UPS contract that finally those UPS drivers are going to get air conditioning in their package cars. But in these states that are vehemently anti-union, the federal government has got to step in. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on, you know, worker protections in my state of Pennsylvania and how well I think the UPS contract went, at least for the package car drivers, to get some air conditioning. I've asked Pennsylvania State Representative Nick Piscitano to come talk with us. He's the legislative representative for the 38th legislative district out there in Allegheny County. Nick, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, how's it going?
All good so far. I got to tell you, you know, I'm looking at this tweet by the president going, it's great that the president's out there saying this. It's great that they're pushing the Department of Labor to actually do something. But should we have to have this? Shouldn't this be just being decent employers? Or I'm struggling where we are as a country.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I think you're seeing in a lot of different industries right now, just the fact that employers don't want to be decent employers. You know, no one's asking to make $1 million a year. Not every worker has to make that kind of wage. We're just asking for dignity at work and safe workplaces and a fair wage that they can put food on the table for their family. And you're seeing people who at the top of these large organizations just denying the humanity of some workers and refusing to give them water breaks during extreme heat, where there, you know, in some of the southern states, you're talking about heat indexes in the 115s or more, and the human body just isn't built for something like that. Yeah. And so to refuse to make reasonable accommodations at work during those kind of circumstances is just unbelievable.
Should be criminal, in my view. We should be locking these folks up. And I've said this for years. I mean, now the good thing is I've always had a union job, and I remember on the heavy heat days, we used to go in and we would get extra break time, we'd get extra water breaks, and the union demanded it. The sad reality is most workers in this country don't have that kind of ability to demand their safety. and sadly are put into positions that they can't defend themselves. And this is where, again, government has to step in. But I don't think it's ever enough.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about the UPS, the Teamsters working at UPS and the delivery cars especially, yeah, people don't believe me when I tell them that those big brown vans that come down your street every day don't have air conditioning. So it's 2023 and people don't believe me that doesn't exist. And that is one of the key things that the Teamsters were fighting for in this contract was just, you know, the dignity of being able to not be overheated for 8 to 10 hours a day as you're carrying heavy packages up and down stairs and getting in a car and driving to the next house and doing it all over again. And it was something like that, so common sense and basic and commonplace now, that they had to fight tooth and nail to get added to the contract. And so it's small little things like that where you're seeing these strikes across the country, and it's because of those small little indignities that keep piling up that the people at the top of these giant corporations refuse to give an inch to any of the workers, even when it's a commonplace thing.
No, and then look, in a lot of places, the organizing that I've talked to people who are fighting for a union, it's not about wages most of the time. It's about dignity. It's not about, you know, the wages they earn. It's about their benefits and the conditions under which they exist. And that to me is well, a sad testament of where we are, but not surprising given the fact that in the private sector, unionized labor is only about 6.7%. And overall, we're just over 10%. There has to be a resurgence. And that comes back to, I think, folks like you passing laws and getting things done to make it a little bit easier and make it to where there isn't as much harassment and intimidation that we see happening. And I know you guys are working on it. So can you give me an update on where we are? I know you're pushing an amendment to protect labor rights. Where are we in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, so last time I was here a couple months ago, we talked a lot about our constitutional amendment in Pennsylvania here that would basically enshrine the right to organize in the Pennsylvania Constitution. You know, it's a federal right now, but we want to strengthen those protections in the state constitution. I'm happy to report that it was passed out of Pennsylvania House of Representatives a couple months ago now. We got one Republican, all Democrats voted for it. It still has to go to the state Senate, which is controlled by Republicans, so we're not sure what to expect over there. But if nothing else, we stood up and we said that we believe in these fundamental American rights, that you have the right to organize, collectively bargain for safe workplaces, fair wages at your place of employment. And I think that sent a great message.
Yeah. Well, it's a which side are you on moment. I mean, this is when you take these votes, you're picking sides. Are you going to be on the right side of history, or are you going to be on the side of taking rights away and dignity away? I mean, to me, the ability to have some say in the workplaces should be a basic human dignity.
Yeah. And I mean, we talked, so we here in Pittsburgh, we had some rallies with UPS about 2 weeks ago. We had a rally with SAG-AFTRA today. That's really what we talked about was, you know, you're not just fighting for a wage, you know, a salary, anything common like that. It's about fair treatment at work. And, you know, for the UPS drivers, I wrote a piece, opinion piece that explained how, you know, the Teamsters are fighting for their members who are UPS drivers. But this contract that they fought for and succeeded on will change the industry for union and non-union shops. So it lifts all workers all at the same time. Even the non-unionized workers who aren't Teamsters are going to benefit from this because the companies that compete with UPS will lose all their workers to UPS if they don't also raise their standards, right? And so the bargaining and the negotiating that the Teamsters went through to lift their members at UPS is also going to benefit the entire industry. When we're talking about Amazon deliveries and FedEx and all those other delivery companies in that space, are going to have to raise their wages and benefits to match or be competitive with UPS now, or they're going to lose all their employees. And so you can see the power of the union, even in a small single shop like UPS, how it reverberates across the industry. And we talked about that today with SAG-AFTRA too. They're fighting for not just their wages over the next couple years of this contract, but how residuals are calculated for the next generation, how the use of AI to artificially take likenesses of people who were previously in shows or movies and recreate them, you know, how people are fairly compensated for that. And so there are big issues at stake here. And that's why you're seeing this wave of strikes and these big issues come to the forefront this summer.
Yeah, no, and it's great to see. But the sad reality is, and this is where, you know, I've had a conversation with friends over the Starbucks organizing. It's great to see the organizing. It's great to see the passion. It's great to see all the excitement. It's great to see all the activity. But our laws are so badly broken that I fear they never get a contract. And that what ends up coming out of the other side of this is, yeah, we spent a lot of time doing this, but didn't get anywhere for it. And this is where I come back to you as a legislator, and I come back to, you know, policymakers going, we've got to make it easier for people who want to join and form unions to be able to do that, because that is the intent, the original intent of the NLRA, to encourage people to join and form unions so that we don't have to pass laws over something simple as getting a water break on a really hot day, that you do that in the workplace. You take care of it among yourself. That seems logical to me.
Yeah. And we have a lot of conversations about, you know, the vote, you know, the organizing vote to determine whether or not you want to affiliate with the union is like the big milestone that a lot of people talk about. And it's certainly important, don't get me wrong. But we've now seen recently that between a successful vote and a first contract is the hardest part of a union organizing drive. It's at that point where the company, if they choose to fight the drive, have the most options on the table. That's the part of the drive where federal and state laws have been weakened the most. And, you know, that we have some folks that, you know, voted to join a union years ago and can never get to that first contract because of all the different legal hurdles that the ownership throws up in place. And, you know, it's kind of a gray area between what the states can do and what the federal government has to do. And a lot of that stuff has been chipped away at the federal level for many decades. But you're right. That is the area that we really need to focus on and make sure we can improve so that workers have that ability, not only to say, you know, we want to form or join a union, but also we can get to that first contract where it becomes a reality. And, you know, that's what our bill enshrining those kinds of rights in the Pennsylvania Constitution is also trying to strengthen those provisions.
No, I mean, and I can tell you firsthand, when I was doing organizer, I had an employer tell me there will never be a contract here. I'll shut the doors and there's nothing you can do about it. And when you have that kind of anti-union sentiment, you know, there's a problem here.
Yeah, I mean, I would shout out my friends and colleagues that are currently on strike with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette here, one of the oldest newspapers in the country, older than the United States Constitution, in fact. You know, they had a contract, then the ownership of that paper did some unfair labor practices, then they were locked out. They've been on strike for a long time. And we're talking about News Guild writers. We're talking about Teamsters who drive the delivery trucks. We're talking about CWA who do the printing. And the ownership of that paper just have no, they want to break the union. They don't care how much money it costs or how bad it ruins the paper's reputation. And they're driving people out of a job and they're ruining a culture institution over their own pride and ego. And so it's just upsetting to see those things happen. And especially in an economy like ours, that's so highly concentrated. And, you know, it's not easy for a competitor to sweep in and pick up all those people out of work and put them to work making a great paper. You know, the market is so concentrated that there is very little competition. So you have these negative outcomes for regions, for workers, for families, and so on.
You know, what's interesting to me is since you brought up the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette situation, they've been on strike over a year. And as you said, look, at one point they were profitable. Now I think they've probably lost most of their advertising, if not all of it. And it reminds me of the Yellow situation where Yellow Freight just went out of business. This kind of everything we have to do to break the union, everything we have to do to get our way, by management and by leadership, and it ends up killing everything. It's toxic across the entire company until eventually you're going to kill the golden goose, and eventually I expect the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette to go down.
Yeah, I certainly hope that doesn't come to pass, but you're right that some of these owners would cut off their nose to spite their face, right? And they just are so singularly focused on worker issues or not giving an inch to the workers because that somehow that makes them weak or I have no idea what other things go through their minds. But it is a shame when you see that anywhere.
Lastly, I want to get to your thoughts on, you've had a couple of op-eds out that I find just terrific. But the one over at, I think it was at the Lehigh Valley newspaper, the Allentown Morning Call, I think it is. You write, Pennsylvania's history is the history of organized labor. Our fathers and mothers, grandfathers and grandmothers, and generations beyond literally risked their lives to stand up against the robber barons and their corrupt allies in government that put the rich above the people. They shed their blood in dangerous mines and factories and died of preventable accidents caused by greed and indifference toward the plight of workers. They led the fight for all the things that we take for granted today, as you point out. Why doesn't that get told more often? I mean, it's not taught in the schools. I would love to see Pennsylvania do what Wisconsin has, and that is to at least have one class of labor history at some point during an education to understand the history of Pennsylvania, the history of Pennsylvania in the labor movement, and the history of the labor movement as a whole, the fight for the 8-hour day, the fight for OSHA, all of those things. Any chance we can move in that direction?
It's a great idea, Rick, and we'll have to look more into that because I think that is a key component missing from, you know, K through 12 education, right? When you have AP American History or whatever you have in high school, that story doesn't get told very much. And, you know, there's a cultural identity in Southwestern PA and other parts of Pennsylvania about how so many people rose to the middle class or even higher on the back of a union job or two. And that needs to be told more often. And it's, you know, I think that because so few of our workers today are unionized, they don't understand what the union actually can do and has done for people, not only in the, you know, today, but also to get the entire economy where it is right now. You know, you talk about the 40-hour work week. That was created by union contracts in steel mill, in the auto factories. And there's a whole litany of things that we just take for granted that were created by union contracts originally and then became so popular and widespread that they spread across all of the other parts of the economy, even the non-unionized ones.
Yep. It's called democracy in the workplace. Maybe we could try it again. But if you come up with a bill, I will do anything I can do to help move that along because I think it's so important. That we educate people on the history of a movement that brought us the 8-hour day and brought us overtime and ended child labor. Because sadly, I don't know if you've noticed, Nick, there are states that are kind of walking away from that ban on child labor thing.
Well, Rick, I just want to give you a quick rundown of what we've done in the Pennsylvania House real quick, and we'll come back to the child labor thing because I have a story to tell you. But, you know, for your listeners who don't know, Democrats took control of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives for the first time in 12 years this year. In the last couple months, we've been busy at work, you know, passing pro-worker legislation that has lingered too long. So I'm just going to run through this list real quick. You know, we passed public sector OSHA, which for people who don't know, OSHA guidelines don't apply if you work in the public sector, which is just crazy to me. Expanding workers' compensation, construction worker misclassification, making it easier for somebody to get workers' compensation. You know, we passed a House resolution designating June 5th to June 9th of this year as Union Organizing Week. That came out of committee on party line. Not a single vote, not a single Republican voted against it in committee, or not a single Republican voted for it in committee, and 64 Republicans voted against it on the floor of the House. That sends a message that you're not even willing to recognize the value of union organizing in this state. We're working on a statewide responsible contractor law. We're extending prevailing wage law to different areas of the economy. I had a bill that implemented safety devices for hotel workers that was hotly contentious and only got a handful of Republican votes. And all it was focused on was making sure housekeepers were safe at work. We had a bill that increased child labor law violation fines. Pennsylvania's were abnormally low. We brought them up in line with some of our surrounding states, both red and blue states. You know, unfortunately, we had Republicans vote against that. 23 Republicans in Pennsylvania House are okay with low child labor law violation fines. I simply don't understand how somebody votes against something like that. Common sense. And like to your point, we don't understand where these people are coming from, that they're so vehemently anti-worker when they represent a ton of workers in their districts. And the last thing I'll mention is that for the first time in a long time, Pennsylvania passed a bill, Pennsylvania House passed a bill to raise the minimum wage in Pennsylvania. That has the federal minimum wage is the Pennsylvania minimum wage, which is criminally low, $7.25. Our plan is a compromise plan that we're hoping our Senate Republican colleagues will take up. It's not everything that we wanted, but it's a long overdue increase to the minimum wage that we passed a couple months ago. You know, it had only passed the Pennsylvania House 103-100. So we are fighting the fight. It's an uphill battle for most times, but we want these issues to be discussed. Yep. We want the public to understand what we're fighting for.
So for all those people that say there's no difference between the parties, they're all the same. I think you just laid out the difference, especially for my union brothers and sisters who are always, you know, I vote for those Republicans who vote against their interests, because I say it all the time, and you don't have to be divisive. I'll be there for you. Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. And I think you just laid it out. How much support did you get for any of those? One or two votes?
Some of them some of them we'd get a handful, sometimes we'd get a little bit more, but there was always opposition on every single piece of these legislation that I just mentioned.
Yeah, the fact that Pat Harkin was fighting for the Jake Schwab bill for how long? What's that been? 15 years now, and it's still not passed, is just beyond me. And for those who don't know, Jake Schwab was worked for a bus company out in Erie, was changing a tire using an airbag to lift, didn't have the right equipment. Was using an airbag to lift a bus. It exploded. It shot a piece of metal, unfortunately, hit him in the head, and he was killed. And there's no OSHA protection. Nobody investigated it. There was nothing. And the family just got basically screwed over. It was a workers' comp claim. So, as I've always said, Nick, you know, if I want to kill somebody, I'll just hire them, because there doesn't seem to be that many penalties for it. So I'm glad to hear that finally we're moving in that direction to maybe hold some people accountable.
Yeah, like I said, it's an uphill battle, but we're ready for the fight, and we're taking it to them, because we want these issues to be discussed, and we want to move the ball forward for Pennsylvania workers.
Now the amendment, because I want to finish up on this, because mm-hmm. I think this is important. The fact that Pennsylvania is a labor state, the fact that there is such a rich history of labor in this state, the fact that there are moneyed interests who are still pushing the no rights at work agenda. I do think it's something that has to be put into our Constitution, because understand the opponents are never going to stop. Even if you get a constitutional amendment, they'll never stop. But I think this is important.
Yeah, and for those who are unaware, I mean, the way we amend the Constitution in Pennsylvania is the Pennsylvania House and Senate have to pass the same bill two times each, and then it goes to the voters. And so, you know, our colleagues in the Senate and our colleagues on the other side have always said, let's just, you know, whether you disagree or agree with this issue, let the voters decide. And I would challenge them on the same thing. You know, let the voters decide if they think workers' rights are important enough to put into our Constitution. Let's see what they have to say. If they say no, then that's fine. But I don't think that's going to be the answer. And that's why my colleagues on the other side of the aisle won't let it go that far. Yeah,
whatever happened to that up or down vote thing? Remember those days? Let the people vote.
Yep. I mean, that was always their argument on a whole litany of constitutional amendments that they pushed over the last couple of years. And so now the shoe's on the other foot. You know, let the people vote. Let's see what they have to say. And let the people be the ultimate arbiter of what goes into the Pennsylvania Constitution. But I'm afraid I don't think it'll get that far. I think politics will interrupt it. But at least we have the power to show the people who are the ones that are holding up against their rights.
So what can we do to help push this along? What can folks do? Is it, you know, should we call in people? Should we yell in? Should we, you know, talking to our neighbors? What should folks be doing to help move this along?
Every Pennsylvanian is represented by a state representative like me in the Pennsylvania House and a state senator in the state house or in the state Senate. Call both of your representatives, your senator and your representative, call them and make sure that they're supportive of this pro-worker agenda that we're talking about. You know, we're willing to negotiate. We're willing to talk to our colleagues in the Senate and on the other side of the aisle. We want to push the ball forward. We don't want the perfect to be the enemy of the good, but we want to get some things done here. And they need to come to the negotiating table and work with us on these issues.
It's something we most certainly need. And we need more folks like you in the legislative bodies, not just here in Pennsylvania, but all across the country. We need more worker-friendly, more worker-centric politicians to get into the halls of power. But, Nick, as always, I appreciate the time. Great stuff. Keep up the great work and come back a little bit more often than, you know, once every 6 months.
Well, I will show you my terrible towel behind me here, Rick, so I'm not sure I'm coming back anytime you have a Cleveland Browns hat on. So next time we're going to have to prearrange that, huh?
I wore this just for you. You know that, don't you?
Yeah, well, lesson learned.
As a kid growing up in Cleveland, you know, I got to do what I got to do. But Nick Piscitano, I appreciate the time, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I did. You know, I know Nick's from the Pittsburgh area. Just a little grind in there, but a good guy. Doing the good work. Fighting the good fight. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1970. That was the day that the NFL Players Association went out on strike. The American Football League and the National Football League officially merged that year. Each league had their own players association. With the league merger, they joined forces into one union. The players elected John Mackey, a tight end with the Baltimore Colts, their first president. Frustrated by pay and lack of control over their careers, the players voted to strike. The strike lasted for 2 days. The owners threatened to cancel the season. The NFL used its powerful PR machine to vilify the players in the press. They characterized the players as greedy and stoked fan anger over the walkout. The two sides met again at the bargaining table and reached a collective bargaining agreement. The agreement covered 4 years. The players won improvements to their pensions and dental care. They also secured the right to have agent representation for the first time. But many of the disagreements over pay and control remained unsettled. In 1974, the players were back out on the picket line for 5 weeks during the summer. 8 years later, a 57-day strike disrupted the season. 7 weeks of games were canceled. Then again, 5 years later, the union went on strike during the season. This time, some of the players crossed the picket lines, including stars like Joe Montana and Lawrence Taylor. This broke the strike without settling on a contract. Today, the NFL Players Association continues to push for improved player safety and revenue sharing. The impact of concussions on players' long-term health remains an important issue for the union.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Senator Tom Cotton, a far-out right-winger, is to good public policy what a boll weevil is to a good cotton crop. Totally destructive. But he is politically candid. Rather than disguising his racial bigotry, for example, Tom flaunts it, as he did last month in an open letter to the retail giant Target. While the senator is usually a devoted corporate-hugging Republican, he lashed out at Target for business policies that he furiously condemns as racially discriminatory against white people. What popped Tom's cork was the chain's pledge to increase the number of black people it hires by 20%. Holy Dixieland, wailed Cotton. Hiring more of them means fewer jobs for us white people. He insisted that Caucasians had the right to take any and all of Target's jobs. Interestingly, Target's gesture to racial equality was made 3 years ago, with no peep of protest from the now-infuriated Cotton. What changed? The GOP's dog-whistling tune, the new politically correct line of anti-black racists, even parroted by today's Republican Supreme Court, is that all efforts to provide racial fairness and balance are, get this, illegal racism against the white majority. So Cotton is just scurrying aboard his party's latest anti-black bandwagon, proclaiming that whites must be protected from racial progress. Not only are Tom and his ilk threatening teachers, librarians, and local governments for promoting equality, but also brand-name corporations that they claim to be woke. That is, not solely focused on profits, but also promoting a little attention to America's need for social justice. This is Jim Hightower saying, ironically, Tom's clique piously claims to be devout Christians. But guess who was supremely woke? Jesus! Tom Cotton needs to review the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus declared that those who hunger and thirst for justice are blessed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, ricksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So, loving the fact that Joe Rogan showing how crazy he is. Evidently, Joe believes that January 6th was a false flag. It's a false flag. Again, pointing at Ray Epps. And isn't Epps suing Fox News? Maybe Rogan's next on the list. He said that it was a fact that the intelligence agencies, all intelligence agencies, were provoking people to enter the Capitol. It's a fact, he said. It's a fact. Is it? Is it a fact? Here to share some thoughts on whether it's a fact or not, I've asked our good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney, to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
So, is it a fact? Did the intelligence agencies did they provoke people to enter the Capitol and defecate on the floor and urinate on desks and break windows? Was that their doing?
Well, let me answer this a couple of ways. First of all, let's look at the past history of the United States up to today. I mean, I wish our intelligence agencies were so manipulative and capable. All right. I mean, the answer is no, but we have to assume that they are really, you know, capable. Okay. They aren't even capable, particularly of doing something that size with the size of a crowd, et cetera. I the worst line though, and I think this was it Tucker Carlson that they were just tourists?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did he?
There was a congressman who said that there was just another day. They were walking between the ropes. There's been a bunch of idiotic statements like that.
It was such a dark day for the U.S. Capitol, dark day for the country, but for the U.S. Capitol in particular. You know, I spent 11 years there. I was in charge of security of the Capitol, and 9-1-1 was harrowing. The, attack of anthrax was harrowing. But this took the cake of all of them. It really did. It took the cake because this was just a complete invasion. People died, and these weren't just, you know, tourists. But how Rogan could come up with the fact that our intel agencies had maybe agents amongst the crowd going, hey, let's go up and attack the Capitol, had nothing to do with all the what's the boys group, whatever they called, I can't remember,
the Proud Boys, the 3%ers,
Boys Gone Wild, Proud Boys, whatever they are. You know, yeah, they had nothing to do with any of this. They let the CIA just handle it all, you know.
Because they're such trusting individuals of federal agents, right?
Right. Just bizarre.
So you're making the argument I make for 9/11, you know, because you got people who are, you know, Bush did 9/11 and they all did 9/11. And I'm going, I don't know. I don't think they could organize a trip to the zoo.
No, our intelligence services have failed and failed and refailed, you know, over the years. I mean, ever since Iran and the fact that they, you know, didn't know Iran was even collapsing. I mean, it just goes forward. They have a role, they have a place, the CIA, the NSA, they try to stop things. But when you really look at their track record, I mean, they just can't, they can't manipulate something like that.
Yeah, no, it is what it is. Speaking of manipulating, and I look at the Koch brothers. One of them is dead, obviously, but Charles Koch has raised $78 million so far this year against Donald Trump. $78 million. Now, he's a billionaire. He could have just reached into his own pocket, but no, he's out there raising money because rich people don't want Trump.
Well, the Koch brothers have you looked into the Quincy Institute at all?
No, but I've heard of it.
Yeah, well, Koch and Soros got together and have funded, begun the funding for the Quincy Institute, and it's for peace, you know. But it's very interesting. And Koch spent his money with Soros, considered the princes of darkness by both sides, you know. depends if you're a Republican or Democrat.
Yep.
They consider them those two. But they did that. But this, you know, Super Political Action Committee raised $78 million. And, you know, that doesn't mean that Koch won't put some more of his, you know, his own money into it. But I think he's smart in doing a super PAC and having other people buy into the super PAC because it makes support, you know.
Right.
People feel invested. It's like in our campaign, we loved the $1. I mean, I had thousands of people contributing $1, $5. You know, it's nice grassroots support, but people do feel invested when they, you know, when they contribute. And even at this higher level, they feel like they're doing something. So I can see where he didn't just fund it himself. He's going to get more bang for his buck by including other people in it.
Yeah, I've got to be honest. I don't like either. I know you said, depending on which side, you like one or the other. I don't like either. I don't think either should exist as billionaires.
Well,
I don't think we should have billionaires. I think we should have a tax code that discourages that kind of enormous wealth that someone can reach into their pockets and fund, you know, the kind of things that Koch has funded over the years and that Soros has funded over the years. And I think that's a nonpartisan, that's a way to unite working people to go, yeah, you're probably right, Rick. We probably shouldn't have such enormous wealth where our lives are now basically the new polo for rich people.
Well, you're right. And when McCain Feingold, you know, put their bill together, and of course McCain became furious with me because I personally, the first round, stopped the bill. I said, I'm not going to have a vote on it. And I told the members, there was, you know, five Republicans and three Democrats. I said, you know, if you want to blame it on me, go ahead. You know, I told him privately, don't blame it too much. But if you want to say, hey, the chairman did this, and frankly, bipartisan, they loved saying that, you know, well, he's not going to have a vote. Private conversations, I had two Democrats who came to me at the time, and they're still there, so I don't want to mention their names. It's not fair to them, but they came to me and they said, look, Soros is spending money against me. And these were Democrats that were not conservative Democrats. And for whatever reason, Soros was going after them. And, you know, they didn't like it. At that time, though, I tried to suggest that we took what they have, what, 507s they had, or
501c3s.
I forget what they put together. But at the time, I said if we were going to have to do McCain's bill, let's make absolute demanding full transparency from these people. Koch or Soros or whoever, these, you know, rich cats, they don't have to tell who they're getting money from. And you want to talk about business people, some of them that, you know, have conflicts of interest, they don't have to tell it. And that's just, any working person should hate that. You're right, no matter whose side of the aisle these people are on.
No, I mean, I've always said that, you know, the fact that you have this kind of mass accumulation of wealth, and that it's, you know, it's like my grandmother always said, you know, the devil's works in idle hands. Well, the devil's works in really loaded pockets. When people
right.
have huge bank accounts and in the kind of power and influence to scare, you know, representatives into secretly going to the opposition and doing what you're saying they're doing, that's more power than I think one person
sure.
should have.
Sure. I've always felt all of these groups should, you know, I mean, I lost the battle, but all of them should have to tell, even including the big ethical groups that go after people, you know, in the Congress and file ethics charges. Well, their groups should have to tell where the money comes from, you know?
No, I'm right there with
Everybody
you.
Everybody should.
Right there with you. I got to get some of your thoughts on the big House Oversight Committee hearing today. You know, evidently, Devin Archer is his name, a former business partner of Hunter Biden, claimed that Hunter was selling the illusion of access to his father. Didn't actually have there's no, basically this guy said there's no there.
Well, both sides claim victory today, but look, and I want to word this very cautiously because I got yelled at for trying to insinuate that if you have substance abuse, you're allowed to do whatever you want. So I'm going to word this cautiously. At some point in time, too, with, you know, substance use, Your mind also does not function correctly, okay, whether it's, you know, alcohol or drugs. And again, that I'm not excusing that it was, you know, if anything was said, it was cool because, you know, he had a substance abuse problem. But at some point in time, also, you know, there's an issue there of, you know, where was his thinking? I'm talking about Hunter Biden, you know, on how to proceed with business and putting that issue aside. But I wanted to throw that out there with this hearing. They're saying, and I think the most problematic conversation today by Devon Archer was when there was, you know, there was a conversation between Biden and his son. There were some business partners. He was on speakerphone. Everybody acknowledges that. But they didn't talk business. But supposedly it happened 20 times. So, you know, I think that's where, you know, a son says, hey, Dad, give me a call. And, you know, Hunter thinks it's okay, and they didn't discuss business, but, you know, 20 phone calls, and I think at some point in time that could be made as a point by the Republicans. I don't think it's a silver bullet that was expected today. Let me, yeah. You know,
oh, no, heaven
that.
Forbid a son calls his father, a father calls his son. Heaven forbid.
Right.
What kind of country are we when yeah. parents talk now, to their siblings?
Now, like anything, this will then simmer because today wasn't what was expected, unless, and if it's not a government investigator, then I don't know who would do it, but unless people start to come forward that were, you know, part of this speakerphone thing and say, well, I felt, you know, and if that happens, then it makes it not look good, not smell good, you know, that's to be seen. But as far as what I was expecting today, you know, was that there were business associates and business was discussed. I was expecting particularly maybe to hear that. Because Devon Archer, he's not like Cohen in the sense he didn't go down for a crime where he was involved with Hunter Biden. Cohen was involved with Donald Trump, so therefore some of the things he says, the lawyers can make it look suspect. But if Devon Archer had made some more, you know, serious statements, it might have had more credibility than, you know, a guy like Cohen, but that right. didn't happen today.
Well, again, as I said from the beginning, I don't know why we're spending so much time and energy on Hunter Biden. He is not an elected official. And until you can draw me that straight line, if there was a perfect phone call, because there've got to be recordings out there somewhere, that perfect phone call of Biden saying, you know, yeah, I'll do this for you, which I know there probably is not. This is a giant nothing burger.
Well, but you know how the things run. I mean, if they find I'll do this for you, then it becomes bribery.
Yeah.
And then if that's not the case, then it becomes influence peddling. And in my particular case, I can't tell you how many times my name was invoked in places and the government would ask us about it. And I didn't do it. I didn't say it. Somebody, you know, oh, yeah, well, I just was in his office yesterday, and they do those types of things. And it even went into the point of Haley Barbour and Jack Abramoff battling each other and throwing anti-Semitic comments back and forth here and there.
Wow.
And I had nothing to do with the two of them doing that, you know, but that happens.
Well, there's a name from the past.
Yeah, Haley Barbour.
Yeah, I forgot all about him, and now you've brought that back. Thanks for that. I got another question for you, because evidently Atlanta isn't about ready to be in lockdown mode. From what I've heard, barricades are being thrown up. And you've got the Fulton County District Attorney, this Fannie Willis, saying, "Hey, stay alert, make decisions that are going to keep your staff safe." It looks like potentially another indictment coming down.
Yeah, I'm thinking that this will be around the first week of August. Now, if not an indictment, but, you know, some announcements, and then indictments no later than they're speculating September. But I think the first week of August is going to reveal a lot. And I got that from a YouTube article today, where this is kind of interesting research. You know, It's just like the news media would watch when pizza deliveries were made to the Pentagon. And if they were big pizza deliveries and the people weren't allowed to go out, that meant they were planning some war action. I mean, that's literally, you know, reporters pay pizza guys to tell them when they're delivering. Well, this is kind of that case in the sense that they have, from the prosecutor's office, they have asked the judges to clear their dockets for around the first week of August, to clear their dockets. So that tells us that something's going down by the first week of August. And if not indictments, there's going to be something, you know, in the sense of an announcement of pending situations that are coming. So,
yeah,
I fully expect that Rudy Giuliani is going to be indicted. And I do expect Trump will have indictments. We know the January 6th indictment's coming. But so it's big when they ask the court to clear the dockets.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I think Trump is going to be indicted. He says he's going to be indicted. Even he thinks it's going to happen. But for me, it's what comes next. It's who the co-conspirators are. Will Lindsey Graham's name be thrown into this? Because if you remember, he made some calls into Georgia as well. What about the attorneys? What about that Lynn Wood or what was the woman's name? I keep forgetting her name. The Kraken.
Oh. Now you made me go on a blank on that one. Snide, no. Oh, thought I'd never forget her name. She's way out there.
Yeah, I'm so glad I have forgotten it, but it'll come to me, or somebody will remind me. But will they be indicted?
I mean, you don't know. I mean, they potentially could, but I say Giuliani because he has now admitted that he said. Made false statements against some of the electioneering, individuals. He's said that already, which is kind of a protection. If you know you're going to be indicted, well, yeah, I made some false statements. Kind of get it out there out front. Of course, you know, the question is, will any of these people that are indicted, will they turn? That's the big question, because are there other things they can lead the prosecutors too. I mean, that's how this all runs. Been there, done it. So, you know, I know.
Wow. You know, that's it's one of those things that just make you go, I can't believe we're in this moment at this time, given the fact that, yeah, it's just remarkable of where we are. And the fact that what was the poll I just saw? 22% of Republicans don't care. No matter what he did,
right?
22% don't care.
Right. And well, then the candidates are into problems because you either attack him for it or you let him go. And if you let him go, you're finished. If you're attacking for it, you're finished. So either way, this call is in his hands. I said today, when I did radio down one of the southern stations today, he can be in shackles in a khaki jumpsuit and appear at the convention and win the convention. All right, that can happen. This all, I'm still arguing, he's not going to do it. I'm still holding to that. But that's going to be in his hands and his decision. He's going to have to start using campaign money. And then if he thinks he's going to lose, that's where I think the ego kicks in and he, you know, calls it a day at some point in time. That's what I think, you know, could happen. But as far as the rejection of him, no. It's weakened a bit, but it's... The support for him is still there. I don't care how many times he'll be indicted.
Yeah, in fact, it came out. Who was it? Someone was joking that it was Thomas Massey, the Republican from Kentucky, who I guess joked that DeSantis needs to get indicted. he's got to close the indictment gap. which
right.
Look, with all the things I've heard coming out of Florida, wouldn't be a shock. Would not be surprising.
I mean, DeSantis has committed political suicide already. You know, he's finished himself off.
Thank goodness. Thank goodness for that. But I got to see if Lindsey Graham gets it. You know, like you said, Rudy, I'm hoping Lynn Wood, throw that name out in there. There's a bunch of them I would like to see, you know. And maybe we will. But as always, Bob, I appreciate
Rudy's on top of the pile there, though.
Oh, yeah. He's on the shirtless and Never mind. Appreciate the time, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Good stuff. Our good friend Bob Ney. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Do you think he's going to be indicted? Do you think it will happen this week? We'll find out. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1981. That was the day the long Major League Baseball strike finally came to an end. The issue that motivated the strike was a dispute between players and management over free agency. Day after summer day slipped by on the calendar with no end in sight. As a result of the strike, a total of 713 games were canceled in the middle of the regular season. And on this day, players and owners reached a compromise, which ended the lengthy strike. In the settlement, a team that lost a free agent could be compensated by drawing from a pool of players. Players agreed to restrict free agency to those who had six or more years in the major leagues. Because of the long strike, the All-Star game was pushed all the way back until August 9th. When you go to the ballpark, you're likely not thinking about labor issues. Nonetheless, the players are unionized and had to fight hard to win free agency and other protections. There have been 8 work stoppages in Major League Baseball. 1981 held the record as the longest, until 1994, that is. The strike started in August and resulted in the cancellation of the whole postseason. It was the first time a major sport had its postseason wiped out by a work stoppage. The strike was not settled until the following April. But the good news today is there are only balls and strikes on the field. So, play ball!
Brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
So I want to finish up with an email from Jack from Wisconsin. Appreciate the email, Jack. And if you want to email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com, that's how you do it. I do answer all emails personally or use them here on the little program. Jack writes, this is in regard to your first segment tonight. When Ronald Reagan came out with his government isn't the answer, government is the problem bull, he says, I think it was about 1981, about 2/3 of Americans were middle class. He says, I recall thinking at the time, our only protection against big government is, or against big corporations, is big government. Government big enough to regulate corporations and strong enough to enforce those regulations. Today, due to deregulation and egregious corporate greed, fewer than half of Americans are middle class. I'm glad that young people are beginning to realize that kind of greed is destroying the middle class and that those corporations need regulation to reverse that trend. It seems that our younger people are voting in ever-increasing numbers. They may well save our country from losing the entire middle class. Jack, and look, I love the optimism. The young people are going to save us. I hope that's true. I see all the union organizing, all the excitement around it. We're going to create a more just economy, a more just future. My problem is we old people are going to hang around way too long to be able to stop any of that excitement. And you've got politicians who are now saying, we need to raise, was it Vivek Ramaswamy saying we should raise the voting age to 25 or join the military? Because, you know, once they can get a hold of you and they can shake you into and mold you how they want. I find it interesting. Now I don't use the word middle class very often, but I get what Jack is saying. We had a prosperous working class in 1981. And my grandparents were in the heart of that. You know, the wages that they earned put them solidly in that middle class category. that Jack talks about. In fact, most of the people that I knew were somewhere in that upper end. Most people were union members. I think 80, we were what, still 25% unionized, maybe 26, somewhere in that range, to where, you know, people were doing well. And what's happened over these years is our greed class, as Jack points out, been robbing us blind. So am I hoping the younger generation wakes up? Yeah, I'm sure hoping. But I'm not.